For the week of May 26, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 192, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. Back in Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, at the world headquarters of BookFilter.com, I'm Michael Gill.
Finally, we can talk about this.
Yes, finally, we can talk about BookFilter, my website about books. Very exciting.
Yes. Now, certainly, I've known that it's been going on for a number of years, and a lot of people were asking Michael, where is Michael? A lot of people in Cannes wanted to know where you were, and I didn't know whether I could tell them. Well, he's working on a very special project, and apparently I probably could have.
Monsieur Giltz.
Where are you? Where was your press conference? That's what I want to know.
Well, it's not officially launched yet. It's in beta mode. But it's a website about books, and before you go to your local bookstore, library, or online retailer, hopefully you'll go to BookFilter to find out what's come out and get great ideas of what books to buy or give as gifts. But we'll talk about it in Inside Baseball.
In fact, we will be, and it will also be talking about the Cannes Film Festival. We're going to be following up our coverage on the Cannes Film Festival during today's show. The Palme d'Or and the rest of the festival's awards were handed out over the weekend, and we'll bring you up to speed on all things Cannes, really. We'll also be discussing how Angelina Jolie's announcement regarding her double mastectomy has caused an uproar in the medical community, but in a good way. It's actually good news. We've got some music news about streaming services and digital downloads and even liner notes. Remember those, Michael? Liner notes?
I do.
You do, yeah. Now, you mentioned that during Inside Baseball, we're going to be talking about BookFilter.com, so we definitely will do that. And of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to you, Michael, entertainment journalist extraordinaire and apparently a book reader, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, I read books.
Yeah, no, I just read the covers and then judge them immediately.
So we have 2 weeks of box office news to catch up on, but the big news is this weekend, the number one movie around the world is Fast and Furious 6. It made $300 million worldwide this weekend. Now, to clarify, in North America, it's Memorial Day weekend. We're recording on Tuesday. Some of these movies opened up on Thursday or even Wednesday. So we're talking about a 4 or 5 or 6 day total for some of these films. But whatever, it's the total amount that we've made in North America so far. And Fast and Furious opened around the world. It made $300 million. It opened a previous weekend in, I think, the UK and Ireland, if that's not redundant. So over there, it made $17 million the weekend before. So its worldwide total after 1.5 weekends, how do we clarify that, is $317 million. That's what the first four films made in total, at best.
So what you're saying, and I'm just trying to judge or try and clarify what you're saying, because I'm often confused as to whether you're liking a film or not, that because of this huge budget that Fast and Furious 6 had, because all of the actors and actresses that have now starred in six films, they want their payday here. You're saying it's a huge flop.
Well, they've been in and out of the film, and they all realize this is their ticket to fame and fortune. I don't know what Michelle Rodriguez made, but it certainly wasn't a ton of money for a big franchise film. It cost $160 million, which is a solid, reasonable budget, especially for a film that has turned into a big franchise. It took James Bond like decades to become a massive, summer-beating blockbuster franchise. Here, Fast and Furious, after four films, it suddenly went into overdrive. The first four movies made about an average of $200 million worldwide. The fifth film, that took off. That made over $600 million worldwide. This one has made $300 million in one weekend.
Well, this speaks
It cost $160 million. They practically doubled their budget in one big week. So they're off to a very solid start for profitability.
Well, this speaks to a couple of things, and I know you want to get on with the rest.
It's not in 3D.
Well, it's not in 3D.
Yay! That's... And it's PG-13. Give me a break. America loves violence. This is an R-rated movie if I ever saw one. But anyway.
But well, and it also speaks to the globalization that is occurring. That Russia, China, South America, they're all getting more screens. And so there are more people seeing movies. And it's a lot easier to see a movie that is made in Hollywood when there aren't two talking heads going back and forth and somebody has to either dub and or subtitles have to be laid in. You know what? Blow something up, have a huge car chase. Those movies do well because it's all action and no dialogue.
All types of movies can be hits worldwide. They don't have to be action
films. Life of Pi. Perfect example.
Yes, exactly. So let's not say that they have to be dumb action films to succeed worldwide. That's not true. But yes, Hollywood movies are very commercial all over the world. This is a big franchise. It's not in 3D, which must have been tempting to them. But thank God they relented and didn't do it. And they're not big stars. But hey, the franchise, it's the sixth film and it's just getting going. So it's kind of amazing. And good to see.
And yet you can see how, you know, a movie just in three movies. Three sequels can actually go the opposite direction.
Right. And one more thing about Fast and Furious 6, the coverage of it. Everyone is catching up with Showbiz Sandbox more and more. Even at local New York One mentioned, it made $300 million worldwide. Everybody covers the box office. More and more, everyone is waking up to the fact. And of course, the studios are making the numbers available. So people are talking about them. They're bigger numbers. Studios are making them more available. And then everybody else passes on the information. So I think within a year, you're going to see everybody doing what we're doing, which is kind of talking about the worldwide box office before North American, because that's what matters. Just like you wouldn't talk about the Mississippi box office, you would talk about North America. You know, why would you pick one little market when you could talk about the overall figures? So that's where we're at. So Fast and Furious is doing great. Hangover 3, however, a massive flop. It grossed $82 million worldwide. It just fell off a cliff. It did half of the business of Hangover 2. Comedy sequels are almost always a bad idea. Usually, they're the province of cheapo indie companies with, you know, crappy little franchises like Police Academy or Porky's or Revenge of the Nerds. Those are the films where you see comedy sequels, junky little movies. This cost $100 million to make, had big names. Of course, Hangover 2 made a lot of money, but this one just fell off a cliff. Word of mouth about Hangover 2 was bad. That's usually what the opening weekend means. It means they didn't like the last movie. Right. When you're talking about a franchise, it means they didn't like the last movie. Of course, we'll get to Star Trek in a minute. But in this case, they also didn't like this movie. The reviews were vicious. The reviews said, this isn't even a comedy. That's how much they hated it. And some people claim that there's a very early scene with a giraffe, and they claim that jumping the shark will now become decapitating the giraffe, that will be the new phrase for when a franchise goes off the rails. Anyway, a big disappointment for that movie from Warner Brothers, $82 million worldwide. However, before we cry, let's just wait and see how it does, because it is doing better overseas. So let's hold on and wait till all the numbers in. It may be commercially, you know, a wash or make a little money, but clearly this is the end of the Hangover series. At number three around the world in a success story is Epic, a family animated film with a female heroine that grossed $65 million worldwide. It's at $86 million and counting. It's a success story for Fox. At number four is the big news from last weekend. Kind of a puzzler. It's Star Trek Into Darkness. It opened last weekend barely equaling the numbers of the reboot when everyone expected it would do better because the first one got great reviews. Everybody loved it. I loved it. The sequel, people were wary of. Is it because Star Trek has a limited audience base? Is it because the new movie isn't as good as the first one, which is true? Who knows what happened, but somehow the word got out. And it's not a disaster. It's not doing terrible, but it's not doing the growth and the big numbers that we expected in North America, where the first one was such a big hit. Remember, the Star Trek reboot made $250 million in North America. It's a lot of money. But there's a lot of money left overseas, because the most that I think any Star Trek movie made was that movie made about $100 million overseas. People don't know the franchise, and they really did introduce it around the world. So this one won't do as well as Star Trek did at North America. That seems likely. But overseas, it may turn out to be a much bigger hit because they've finally woken up the world to the charms of the series. And so now maybe that's where the payoff will be. You know, so we'll have to see. But Star Trek Into Darkness, it opened up last weekend, did kind of disappointing, not embarrassing. But this weekend, it almost beat Hangover 3 on Saturday and Sunday. So Star Trek Into Darkness, it made $60 million. It's at $257 million worldwide. And $102 million of that comes from overseas. So it's already practically equaled what it made in its entire run last time around. So there's a lot of room for growth overseas. So yes, not as good here in North America as we hoped, but not a disaster. And if it can really grow the overseas market, they may see this as a big win for them anyway. And number five around the world is The Great Gatsby, which, of course, opened at Cannes after it played in North America. It's made $41 million around the world this week. It's at $200 million total and counting. Now, the budget, depending on who you speak to, is anywhere from $105 million to $190 million, which is certainly a big difference. I'm guessing it's closer to $190 million. I don't know about you, Sperling, but this looks like a very expensive film with big stars. period detail, 3D, I think it costs a lot of money.
I think that it probably with advertising.
No, then it's $300
million.
They don't include advertising in the budget. This was a big, splashy worldwide launch. They definitely spent $100 million on the advertising.
I know this much. I know that they're considering this a success. And I know
they can't yet because it's only made $200 million. It's starting to fall fast already in North America. Well, you got to see where it ends up. That's what. Don't you listen to the show?
I do. And in fact, I do. Ironically.
So I know they want to say it's a success because it certainly did a lot better than I thought. No question about that. But you know, come on. Australia cost $150 million to make. You're telling me, you know, this movie with all these stars in it, then the period detail and the splash of it, that it costs less than Australia? Give me a break.
Well, I think maybe because Australia, Baz Luhrmann's last film, cost so much to make and made so little, he may not have been given as big a budget this time around.
Australia was Hugh Jackman. This is Leonardo DiCaprio, Tobey Maguire, Carey Mulligan with one of the most famous novels of all time. This True. Was not made on a dime. And his first three movies all were profitable, sometimes wildly profitable, with Moulin Rouge. So come on.
Yeah, if anything, it was made on a quarter. maybe a silver dollar. I don't know.
Well, let's say it costs $150 million to make. It needs to make, you know, what about $400 million to be profitable?
Double the budget. It needs to make $400 million, $320 million in profit.
Yeah, but again, it depends. You know, you're making most of your money overseas, et cetera. It's doing a lot better than we thought. I was wrong about Star Trek. I was wrong about The Great Gatsby. I thought Star Trek would do better. I thought Gatsby would do worse. That $200 million so far, let's see where it ends up. Nobody can question that Iron Man 3 is a big success. It's the fifth highest grossing film of all time worldwide. It made another $41 million. It's at $1.15 billion and counting. At number seven is The Croods, which made another $7 million. It's at $565 million. And that, of course, comes from DreamWorks Animation. So naturally, made over $500 million. Heads will roll. Number eight is Montage, which made $3.3 million. It's at $7.6 million and counting. That's a French film, I think.
I believe so.
Yes.
French word, I might add.
Oui. I'm not sure what it's about, so I apologize. I forgot to look that up. At number nine, we have to sort of put this, I think, in the loss column. Oblivion, the sci-fi film starring Tom Cruise. It made $3 million. It's at $266 million worldwide and counting, but it's coming to the end of its run, as far as I can tell. I don't think there are any really big markets left for this movie, and it was pretty expensive to make, so it's kind of a wash. I mean, it barely made more than Jack Reacher, which was sort of a low-budget flick, and with Tom Cruise in on the profit participation, you have to figure they didn't lose their shirts, but they certainly didn't make any money on that one.
No, they'll make money on all the ancillary stuff, like home video and television. I mean, that they'll make money on, but
Right, it's a wash. They're going to make some money, but they're not going to rake it in like they want.
No, it's not a $2 billion franchise.
No, few things are. At number 10 is Mud, the independent film by the director of Take Shelter and Shotgun Stories.
Yes.
Beg your pardon. $2.3 million it made. It's at $20 million worldwide and counting. The same amount as the Place Beyond the Pines, I think. That's made about $20 million worldwide. Two independent films, both doing good business at the box office. Though The Place Beyond the Pines, I think, was a bit pricey. And number 11, a film that opened at Cannes, The Great Beauty. It made $2.3 million, opening just as it premiered at Cannes. At number 12, Evil Dead. At number 13, Only God Forgives, another film from Cannes, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, starring Ryan Gosling. It made $1.5 million. I assume it opened in France. I'm not sure. But those are two of the films that we'll soon be talking about at Cannes.
That's true. And I think the title Only God Forgives is there should be an extended title. Only God Forgives Me for Making This Bad Movie.
Ooh, yes. It did not do well. And in the independent circle, Before Midnight, Ethan Hawke made a terrific amount of money, made about $64,000 per screen on only five screens. So an excellent opening for the latest in that franchise, if we can call it that, by director Richard Linklater.
And people are loving that movie.
Yes, yes. It has a passionate fan base. As long as they keep the budget low, they can make them for the rest of their life. They say this one might be the last one, but I don't know.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, 20 years later, why not? Why not have him and Julie Delpy get together one more time?
Well, what is there? There was Before Sunrise, After Midnight. I mean, is there anything left? Is there any time that's
left? Dusk.
How about Twilight? Oh,
yes,
no,
the,
that's
the magic hour that Terrence Malick, if he made him, all these movies would be set at Twilight.
That's true. I think that name's been taken, though, however.
That's true. We'll call it the magic hour.
That's true. Now, I was unaware that all of these Cannes films would be opening shortly after and or during the festival.
That's right. So you were at Cannes. I don't want to talk about Cannes because Cannes is stupid and I wasn't there, but I guess we have to.
Well, so it's only, you can only talk about it when you go. Is that it?
Right. It actually made quite a bit of news in its first week. There were a couple burglaries, but again, these are high profile burglaries of jewelers and important people. It's not like you were walking down the Croisette fearing for your life.
Yeah, no, this was, you know, everybody saying, oh, it's an inside job. It's an inside job. Kind of like the whole, I guess in South Africa, there was this big Ocean's 11 type burglary of millions of South African dollars.
Wow.
And of a concert, Justin Bieber and John Bon Jovi, they were, they performed.
What, did people pay in cash as they showed up?
Apparently, they must have because they you know, they broke into the safe, they broke into this room where the safe was and stole all the money. This was, you know, again, jewels in a safe, as Stephen Garrett pointed out during our special episode from Cannes. You know, Chopard got way more in publicity than they paid. The jewels are insured, and I'm sure they'll catch whoever took them. So you can't beat, you know, that kind of publicity.
And my dad was worried I was being shot at, but you covered that as well in the special episode. If you haven't caught it, catch the special episode from Cannes. Even though I'm not on the show, it was still a good one.
Yes.
So to me, looking back, it looks like just an overall feel that this was a vintage year for Cannes. That's the impression from America. It seemed like some major directors came through, some new talent burst out. There seemed to be, you didn't have to go many days without hearing about a good movie, and there were good movies right up till the end, especially on the final Thursday where the big film of the fest burst out. It sounded like overall, you know, usually you go to Cannes and somebody says, it's the worst Cannes ever. I don't know if anybody was saying that this year. What was the impression for you?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that it seems like a vintage year. Certainly, it had the makings of one. I mean, you had James Gray, Jim Jarmusch, the Coen brothers, Asghar Farhadi, who won an Oscar for A Separation. You had Paolo Sorrentino, the Italian director who directed The Great Beauty. All of these, you know, a film from China by Zhai Zhangke. Alexander Payne was there with Nebraska. All of these, and of course, Baz Luhrmann opened the festival. So it really did have the makings of a great festival. And I have to say, there was nothing there that was absolutely awful, except maybe Ellie or Helly or whatever you want to.
Which won an award for best director?
Yes, I cannot for the life of me. Nobody understands, by the way. Nobody I've spoken with in any country understands how Amat Escalante won for Helly. They cannot figure it out.
So that was the dog of the fest. So it was a solid fest, but not one that got you your pulse racing. Is that what you're saying?
No, there were some standout, definitely some standouts, as there always are.
Yeah.
And I have to say, we recorded you know, last Wednesday, and Stephen and I went off to see Blue is the Warmest Color, or as most people in Cannes referred to it, the 3-hour lesbian movie. That's pretty much how everybody referred to it. Eventually, they figured out who directed it. They called it the Kashish movie. Because that's the director.
The 3-hour lesbian movie directed by Kashish.
Right. Who is a French Tunisian filmmaker. It stars, you know, I wish I could pronounce the stars of some of these movies.
Well, but this is the film of the fest. It won the Palme d'Or. It got rave reviews from the Europeans. I mean, they just were crazy about it. When you look in Le Film Français and they have a roundup of critics, there were more palms, which is a 4-star rating, than I've seen in a long time. For just one movie. It was, they just went nuts about it. And the Americans admired and respected it as well. But it just was, you know, crazy talk of the fest right towards the end. People went nuts for it. They loved it.
Yes, it was an amazing movie based on a graphic novel, which is, you know, a French graphic novel. It stars Léa Seydoux, who is well known in America, or I don't want to say well known, but she's known in America.
For?
Pirates of the Caribbean, I believe she starred in one of the Pirates of the Caribbean.
She's the female lead?
I believe so. And she also...
I never saw the other two.
Yeah. Adele, now, she stars as the girl with the blue hair. That is our...
The love interest of
our main character, Adele Exarchopoulou. I can't pronounce her last name.
A young French actress we don't know.
Right, correct. And the whole film is a...
It's just very Dardenne. It's so close up and intimate is how people keep describing it. It's very non-linear. It's not a strong plot. It's just sort of... talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly everything you're saying. It's so poetic and so... It just kind of wraps you up. And by the end, you're thinking, okay, it could have been a bit shorter, but it couldn't be a bit shorter. And yet... It's about this girl, Adele, who's at 17, and she's, of course... Her first love, and she's meeting boys, and she's a little confused. Is she kind of likes girls, but then she meets this girl named Emma, played by Lea Seydoux. With blue hair, and basically it's a story about sexual awakening. It's a story about becoming an adult. It's a story about how you are treated as a homosexual by your peers when you're younger, because she's still in high school when they meet, and you know all of her friends are teasing her for being a lesbian, even though she's hiding it. It's about being in the closet, not letting people know. I mean, it's about so much, and yet nothing is ever spoken of it, about what it really is about. And as Spielberg said during the press conference for the award winners, as much is said in the silence between these two women than their dialogue itself.
Well, and that's why you go to Cannes, isn't it? To see a new talent, a talent that people haven't paid a lot of attention to, a new film that blows you away. It's not going to make $300 million at the box office, but everybody feels here's a major talent. Here's a wonderful film. It captured everybody's heart. It's going to go on and play around the world. You know, that's why you go.
Wait a second. I'm going to pause you right there. And here's why. And as Christian Monjou said, he's the Romanian filmmaker who was on the jury with Spielberg. He said, listen, when you sit in a theater and you forget that you're watching a movie, that's a good thing. But here's the thing. You say it's going to play around the world. However, this is a film that features some extended, really, really long scenes of graphic sexual content. And
don't say graphic, just say sex or intimacy. It's like we see a million movies with graphic sexual content, if you want to put it in those terms. It's intimate. There's sex in it.
Yeah. But almost...
It's not a porn film.
It's not a porn film, though...
Well, we're not saying it's going to play in Iran or China. Though, we're talking about the West.
Wait a second. Let me finish.
All right.
You say it's not a porn film, though there are some who might disagree with you. Now, I'm not disagreeing with you.
What would you rather your teenage daughter see, this or Fast and Furious 6?
Given that my teenage daughter,
I'm just saying if you had one,
well, probably this.
Right. Thank you. It's art
now. But so what I'm saying is,
I don't care about those debates. It's a film. It will play in throughout the West.
As you're watching the film. Okay. As you're watching the film, and they leave nothing to the imagination. Okay. So that, let's just put it that way. That's probably the best way to put it.
Please. It's just a film with two women. That's why you're so overwrought about it.
And there's also, it's not just "quote unquote" lesbian sex that is shown. Okay, so let's stop there. It has nothing to do with whether it's straight or gay. It is very, like I said, it's very graphic in nature in that it is showing.
Right.
Everything.
So, forget the rest. You know, this talk about France and Canada and the normal world, Europe, in America, they don't mind if you put a gun to someone's head and blow it up. But God forbid you show two people having sex.
Well, now let me. I think that as I was watching it, I thought, why is this scene going on and on and on? But by the end of it, you realize it couldn't have been any shorter, that it was all there for a reason. And so you go, now I get it. Yes, it's needed. Now I understand. And that's how brilliant this movie is. It really is a masterpiece. I talked to one journalist who actually lives in Lille, where the film was shot, and knows Lea Seydoux. And this was, she basically had a mental breakdown. This film was so trying, she had a mental breakdown as the film was being made because it was so demanding, which is probably why.
Was she hospitalized?
No, very close to it.
And she didn't have a mental breakdown. What?
Yeah.
She was moved by the film.
Not moved by the film. I think being pushed by the director is really what I would say.
Why would she have a mental breakdown watching this movie?
Not watching the movie, making the movie.
Oh, the director. I thought you were... I got confused by what you were saying.
I'm saying Lea Seydoux was pushed by the director.
That's not... Again, we're dramatizing it. It's, you know, come on. It's a film.
Needless to say, Spielberg and the jury took... He was the president of the jury, took an unusual step, and possibly even unprecedented, where they gave the Palme d'Or not just to Kashish, Abdelatif Kashish, the filmmaker, but also to the two actresses. So it was shared by all three of them.
Well, that's sweet.
And it was, that was, I would agree. I think a lot of people were surprised when it was announced that Bernice Bejot, probably best known for The Artist, she won Best Actress. Everybody, there was kind of a gasp.
Well, no, because when you're walking at home, you go, okay, that means Blue is the Warmest Color is winning Best Film. I mean, that's how it works. They love to share the, they love to share their awards. When you know it didn't get anything else, it didn't get screenwriting, it didn't get directing, it didn't get actress, then you know it's winning the Palme d'Or. You just do. Or at worst, the runner-up.
That's right. And the runner-up this year was the Coen brothers, Inside Llewyn Davis, which of course is the film about, I guess it's set in the early 1960s as the, you know, the emerging New York folk scene.
Right. And that got great reviews. That did really well. A lot of people liked that. From outside, it looked like that was the film of the fest until Blue is the Warmest Color showed up. So, you know, they've been loved by Khan, but it sounds like, you know, that's a very notable film. Some people were a little mixed on the Asghar Farhadi, but it sounds like The Past is a very worthy film. His last two films have been brilliant.
Yeah, this film goes on a little bit too long.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, The Separation was his last film, The Past. So Bernice Bejot won for The Past. And here's what's interesting. Bernice Bejot is married to Michael Hazanavicius, who is, of course, the director of The Artist. Who is working with Michael Hazanavicius next?
I don't know.
Let's see if Spielberg does. Let's keep an eye on that.
What?
Let's find out if Steven Spielberg, if an announcement is made within the next couple of months that Steven Spielberg and Michael Hazanavicius will be working together. Let's just keep an eye on that.
You mean he's producing something of his?
Possibly. You know what? I'm trying to say something here without saying something because I'm not allowed to.
Well, then you shouldn't.
Okay. Well, then let's move on to...
So did you see one film I was interested in that I would have loved to have seen is by the director of XXY, which is a terrific film about a transgender teen, or an intersex teen, I should say, who hadn't chosen yet whether to have an operation to choose a sexual gender or would stay the way they were. Now, her new film is called Wakolda, directed by Lucia Puenzo. I wondered if you saw it.
I did not see it.
Sorry I brought it up.
Because several people had seen it. And said, it's not that great.
Oh, well, it did get an award, I believe, at the end, or it got great reviews about Nazis hiding in Patagonia. It got an award in one of the sidebars, I believe.
Yes. Now, Nebraska, directed by Alexander Payne, shot in color and then changed to grainy black and white, stars Bruce Dern in a, you know, Oscar-worthy role.
Is it? I mean, that's what they want you to say in the ad campaign, but is it? I know it won Best Actor, but do you think it is?
I think he probably will.
I'm asking if you think it's worth it. I'm not asking if he'll get nominated for it. I'm asking if you think it was a great performance.
Yes, it was a good performance.
It a good film?
I liked it.
No,
I liked it. I thought it was very sweet.
Is it one of your favorite films of the year?
It's one of my favorite films of this half of the year. I know people like Stephen Garrett and others hated it.
Yeah. I think this is a, you know, he might get nominated, but this sounds like a film that is pure art house.
Yeah, pure art house, not nearly as good as The Descendants, but it's still a solid movie.
But yeah, so there you go. It was a good year for Americans. James Gray got good notices for his film, The Immigrant, with Marion Cotillard, especially being singled out as having given a great performance. She's going to be a likely award winner come the end of the year. Joaquin Phoenix also stars in that. Alexander Payne's film won an award. The Coen brothers won an award. Jim Jarmusch had a funky little vampire flick towards the end of the fest starring Tilda Swinton. So some of them came through. Some of their
Roman Polanski. Don't forget about Roman Polanski.
Yeah, but that got terrible reviews.
Venus and Fur.
Terrible review. He didn't come through. What do you mean? What's to remember? He delivered a junky, bad movie based on a play that should not have been turned into a film. Venus and Fur is a play. It does not work as a movie. It's a stupid play to turn into a film, and it got poor reviews. Did you like it?
I didn't see it.
Did anybody else like it that you spoke to?
I didn't talk to anybody.
Then why are we going to remember it?
I'm just saying it
aired on Saturday because it was a piece of junk.
Right, after everybody
after
left.
Everybody was gone. Yeah. What's to remember?
And, why you know, I also heard I heard mixed things about the James Gray as well. I did not see that because I was already commuting back to Los Angeles. I heard some mixed things about it that... yes, solid movie. Yes, great acting. And yet it's kind of a melodrama and really no reason for it to exist. So,
Well, all I know is that all the reviews singled out Cotillard as having given a brilliant performance. He's not a big commercial director. I really only have liked his first film, Little Odessa, but it sounds like I might get pulled in. I've seen all of them since. I admire them all, even if I don't love them. None of them have been on my best of the year list. Perhaps this won't be either. But it sounds like a worthy film to see at a festival.
Yes, and I would agree with you. Little Odessa, great film. And his other films, I'm completely, I back everything you just said. One film that I was shocked didn't win anything at all was Paolo Sorrentino's The Great Beauty, La Gran Bellezza. This is the Italian film. It's a lot like La Dolce Vita. It takes place in Rome, following an older writer who's. It's very existential, and it's long, and it's a beautiful movie. And yet, nothing, not a thing. Not for the actor, not for the director. Instead, you had the jury giving awards to. I guess screenplay went to
Gia.
Yeah, Zhai Zhongke's A Touch of Sin, which is the story that takes place in China. Kind of. Four stories in one. It's an omnibus film. All true stories that are portrayed in the film and intertwined in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Very good film. Well, a good film. And then, like Father, Like Son, won some prize. I can't remember what. I think it was a grand or a jury prize, which was the Japanese film that depicted two families. The kids were switched at birth. The 6-year-old sons were switched at birth, and whether they switch back or not.
I hate when that happens. There was an Israeli film just like that last year. So overall, how was the American attendance? Were a lot of people there in force? Was it just a typical con? Did you notice any big trends?
I think the trend is people are beginning to go, wow, this is really expensive to come here. I mean, people have said that.
That's been going on for years. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're beginning to see people not come. Bruce Kirkland from the Toronto Sun.
Oh, wow. He didn't show up.
He was not there. First time in 30 some odd years that this man and this journalist has not made it to Cannes. That should tell you something. And that's because the paper didn't want to send him.
So fewer people are coming, I guess, right?
Yes.
Now, one reason for that, something people may not know, is that Cannes actually pays for some journalists to come to the festival. It sounds a little iffy. We've talked about it before. In this case, the ethics for everything are very fluid. I'm not some dogmatic whatever. I say if your outlet can't afford to send you and the festival is willing to have you pay as opposed to an actual director or company or whatever, you're going there as the festival to cover it and they understand that you're going to say positive and negative things about it. If there's no other way to cover it and you make that clear and above board, I have no problem with that. But the fact is they actually have a fund where they pay some people, they supplement or support or fully pay for like their plane ticket or whatever. They help people come to the fest. They say your coverage is important. We know you can't afford to come here. And we're going to give you, €1,000 or whatever to help you afford to come to Cannes.
Right. And it's usually from countries like, countries that wouldn't ordinarily send a representative or a journalist. So
right. Europe is easy. People in Europe can get there. So you talk about North America, South America, Africa, Asia, all these kinds. And it's not like they're sending tons of people, but they do when there's people that they value and they know they can't come anymore. They can't afford it. They do offer to help. In fact, they offered to give me a couple $100s. I think they offered me like €300, I want to say, 2 years ago when I said I couldn't come, I couldn't afford it. They actually offered to say, well, would you be willing to take or would it help if we gave you €300 to come to the fest, which I was frankly touched by and thrilled, but it wasn't remotely enough to even cover the increase in plane ticket. Plane tickets had really exploded in the last few years.
Yes, they have,
and so I'm
actually.
Like, that's all right. I'd still have to pay every penny I paid the year before. So it doesn't really help, but thanks for the offer. So they do that. That's how I found out about it, when they actually offered and said, hey, we know you can't afford it. Would €300 make the difference? And I said, no, it wouldn't, but 3,000 sure would.
Well, now I will say Cannes is not unlike many festivals that actually they call them invited journalists, that when they invite the journalists to come, they will pay certain aspects of the journalist's trip. These are usually for journalists that are where they want coverage from that particular region.
Right. So as long as I think the journalists should be above board about it and tell people, I don't think most of them do. And it's not quite like a press junket where you're just taking a trip to San Francisco and then promising to turn out three puff pieces on, some movie. This is, you're covering the festival. I can understand in this day and age why it's happening, because there are no jobs left. People don't even have jobs at newspapers anymore. So if they want to go to Cannes like me, they got to pay it all out of their own pocket. I've lost money for 10 years on Cannes. So they're saying, hey, it's worth our money to spend to get some of this coverage. That seems like a reasonable thing. And they had to cut back this year, or they reallocated their funds, or I don't know what. But some journalists who've gone to Cannes for many years weren't able to go this year because Cannes didn't have the money to help them make it feasible.
Well, we don't necessarily, I can't speak to that. I don't know whether that's the case. I do know that there are, you know, there are fewer outlets.
Well, that's what I heard.
Okay, that's what you heard.
I know it's happened in at least one case.
Okay. Then that said, you know, trends, it rained like half the time, which happened the year before. And people are saying, gee, this is the new can because of global warming. The rain, which is usually around in April, is now staying.
Thanks, Al Gore.
Yes.
It's all his fault.
Let's blame Al Gore. But, you know, overall, again, I always say it's 12 days in May. It is my Christmas.
Absolutely. And if you can see three movies that end up on your best of the year list, to me, that's a good con. And you saw three films, I think, that will be on your best of the year list.
I think certainly the more I think about Blue is the Warmest Color, the more I fall in love with it.
Are you trying to write ad copy?
No, I'm not.
Well, you know, that's the power of movies, and that's the power of movie stars, which we learned also while you were away at Cannes, didn't we?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, as I was putting the show together last week, when I thought, oh, we'll still do a show, and it's going to be possible despite the time difference and my schedule and your schedule, etc., I ran across this story that Angelina Jolie had gone, quote-unquote, public about her double mastectomy. And I thought, how did I not see this until like 5, 6, 7 days later? And it's because when you're in Cannes and you're covering that festival and you're doing all sorts, you know, you have all sorts of meetings, you don't have time to stay on top of like what's going on in the world. This was one of those incidents. And so I began to read it and I thought, is this true? Why would she do this? And the more I read, I thought, ah, okay. Now, as you know, Michael, I have a lot of connection to the medical world for many reasons. And I wondered whether her announcement would mean anything, not only to people who follow celebrities, but more
the medical world.
The medical world. And I can tell you that from New York, even London, to all the way to Los Angeles, her announcement saying, I have BRCA1, which is a gene that increases the risk of developing certain cancers such as breast cancer and ovarian cancer. It becomes a matter of when, not if, you will get cancer. Her mother died from ovarian cancer at the age of 56. I think her aunt just passed away.
After she made her announcement, her aunt died of breast cancer.
Right.
Absolutely.
So 2 weeks after she makes this announcement, her aunt dies of breast cancer. And for her to go public, I mean, she's kind of known as being this buxom, voluptuous woman, and say that part of the reason she's known, that she's changing that, I thought that was very brave, as many people did. But what she has done is she has made public some of the ways people discover they have BRCA1 or BRCA2, this gene mutation, and what some of the procedures are that can help prevent people from getting cancer who have this mutation.
Right. Unfortunately, the test is $4,000, I believe, from a story I saw in the Times. So it's very expensive. Obviously, she can afford it, but a number of women wouldn't be able to afford this test to find out if they have BRCA1, which is a shame. It's far more common than I thought. I think from the numbers, it looks like 1 out of 100 women will have it.
Yes.
And that's quite a lot. That's 15, 18 million women.
I mean, Christina Applegate had it. Sheryl Crow, when they developed breast cancer, they had mastectomies because the reality was it would continue if they didn't.
Right. A lumpectomy or a partial mastectomy was not an option.
Was not an option. And these days, the way that they are able to do these operations, they actually do reconstructive surgery where you don't notice.
If you can afford it.
If you can afford it, that is true.
Yeah, it's considered a cosmetic surgery, I believe. It's not covered by Medicaid.
I can't answer
that. The mastectomy is covered, but the reconstruction, I believe, is not covered.
Possibly. Yeah, I can't speak to that. What I can say is that doctors in their weekly meetings talked about, gee, this nipple delay portion of the procedure, which is what Angelina Jolie had, and she was public about. You know, what is it? How do you do it? What does it mean? And it's basically a way to spare the nipple and possibly save the nipple. But of course, it then increases the chances of actually getting cancer because you have some of the skin from around the nipple still on the tissue. That said, this is something that's relatively new, relatively, I don't want to say modern, but it's something that's being done more and more.
Hmm.
And well, so people are talking about it. geneticists are beginning to get phone calls.
And sure, the phones ring off the hook for a week after it happens, but hopefully long term there'll be a serious new level of awareness. That's why she chose to be public about it. But there are two things that are fascinating about this that are more germane to our show. One, how the hell did she keep it secret?
Well, I can tell you how she kept it secret.
But I mean, that's unbelievable. She had surgery and a diagnosis and surgery and a double mastectomy and reconstructive surgery, and nobody knew about it. How the heck did she do it?
Well, okay. I'm walking down lots of roads where I'm not supposed to say things, but
Obviously, rich people can go to private surgeons. Right. They can have things done in private. She's not checking into the local hospital.
No, her doctor was Dr. Christy Funk, who is known for operating on high-end patients like Angelina Jolie.
High-end? What do you mean high-end? Rich?
Yeah, rich people, basically.
Okay. High-end.
Celebrities, basically.
Yeah, she's not high-end. What are you, a car dealer? She's a celebrity doctor. She deals with rich people.
Right. She performed the surgery at Pink Lotus. Again,
what is Pink Lotus?
A specialist. They basically specialize in this type of surgery on women for whether it's mastectomies or, you know, ovarian cancers or cervical cancer. This is what they specialize in. She had the operation on a Saturday, which means that people wouldn't be around necessarily.
Well, there's still people at the hospital.
Yes.
And there's doctors and nurses and patients, you know, people involved.
Right. She then went and recovered at a hotel known as Serenity, where it's aftercare basically for this type
of people.
Yeah.
Right. So they're discreet.
And then she had all of her post-op visits done at home. So the fact that she was able to go from February to mid-May and control the whole thing is remarkable. I mean, this is a woman that has pictures of herself and her children, you know, taken
at the grocery store.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable to me. She was very smart about it. And I guess if you really don't want to be noticed, there's ways not to be noticed.
Well, you need the money, but
yes.
In this case, you know, she went the full nine yards and kept it secret. And all credit to Pink Lotus and Serenity for being discreet, because there are nurses there and people who could, you know, that's their job, but you can make a lot of money linking a story like that. You get six figures.
Yes.
So, you know, wow. But that's amazing. The other thing is it shows the continued power of celebrity.
That's true.
You know? She really brought a lot of attention to it. It may be short term, but, you know, I'm sure she'll talk about it again over the years. You know, it's like celebrities, they could go off and do whatever. She chose to be public about it. She chose to control when it came out and then talk about it, knowing it would help some other women. And it's pretty amazing.
And it's not only helping other women. I mean, it's not only causing a conversation amongst potential patients, but also their doctors.
It
brought the issue to bear for doctors as well. They're now looking at it again.
Well, so that's cool. So, you know, now what about the patient of music, which was on life support for a while, but seems to be showing a new little signs of vigor thanks to subscription services and streaming music and apps like Shazam. What's happening in the world of music?
Well, I'm going to try and cover our music in one fell swoop. We have a couple stories here, four stories.
Woo!
Okay, here we go. Because apparently, a new study has discovered that 70% of users who sign up for streaming services ultimately become inactive, even though the services are free, of course, like Spotify and, well, most of them are free, Pandora. Now, maybe music fans are purchasing their music instead, either on CD or more increasingly digitally. And after all, digital downloads have increased to, I think it was $4.1 billion globally in 2012. And that's going to benefit music discovery services such as Shazam. In fact, Shazam is generating $300 million in music sales annually. So when you do the math on all that, they are responsible for one out of every 14 downloads. Though some music lovers, most of them a little older, like you and I, Michael, they have never been fans of digital streaming or digital downloads. And that's because they miss liner notes, the parts of a CD or album that they give you the production information and the credits for a given recording, who played trumpet, who produced it, etc. After a year-long campaign by the Recording Academy, however, liner notes are making their way onto digital tracks, with Rhapsody, the service Rhapsody, being the first in the group to provide them. Of course, whether you're listening to music via streaming services like Rhapsody and Spotify or downloading it through iTunes and Amazon, you still need to hear about or learn about new music. With more and more music to choose from, you know, it's easier to record, easier to distribute, etc. You know, it can be a little overwhelming. And that might be why, a week ago, Kanye West took this unusual approach to promote his upcoming album by projecting music videos of the record's first single onto 66 buildings around the world on the same night. So there you go. Four news stories in under a minute.
Or my head hurts.
Yes. How many numbers did I mention there? Did I mention
8,000 numbers?
Yes. So now,
so a study, the things I hate most, a study shows, well, though, all right, a study claims that in its own little way, it, you know, revealed something. All right. So we would not be surprised to know that people check out Pandora and Spotify and then end up not using it.
Right.
They either get bored, they get into it for a few weeks or months, and then they just get bored and move on. That's hardly surprising.
Or there's people like you who will like just check in because they need to know what it's about and then have no intention of ever using it.
Right. I mean, I'm sure that Spotify counts me as a user, which is absurd because I just wanted to see what the site was. I signed up once. I used it for less than an hour. I've never been back.
Well, a couple things.
If I signed up for Spotify 6 months ago and I have less than 1 hour of usage, they should not be counting me as a user.
A couple points here. Always look at the qualifiers on that. How many subscribers do they have?
Well, subscribers are people who pay for it.
Exactly.
That's very different. Yeah, but they love to tout the big number, which is users.
How many active monthly users do they have?
Right.
Because then if they just say, 18 million people use Spotify, well, then yes, they're counting you. But if they say they have 5 million active monthly users, well, then no, they're not.
So this study is big deal. I mean, give me a break. It reveals nothing that we wouldn't have guessed even on our own. Secondly, Shazam. Now, what's Shazam again? Shazam is that app that you use to say, hey, what song is this, right? You hold it up, it samples the song, and it tells you you're listening to Billy Joel's Allentown or something like that.
Right, exactly, because there's a thumbprint to every song, and so it finds the thumbprint, goes and checks the database, and comes back and says Billy Joel's Allentown, or you know Rolling Stones' Tattoo You, or you know, or
whatever the song is that you're listening to. Now Shazam says that they've added this new feature, of course, where if you listen to a song and they sample it and they say that's the song you're listening to, you can press a button and buy it.
Right,
right?
Now they've had that
is it through iTunes or who's it through?
It's through iTunes and Amazon, etc.
Yeah. It's not. You could choose.
I think so. I'm pretty sure that's the case. And they're not saying, this is a new feature. They're saying, by the way.
No. I'm just saying this is a feature that they've had. They didn't have it at the beginning, and now they're saying we generated last year $300 million in sales via that service. So Shazam is saying, hey, we are generating $300 million in sales because people check our device. They say, what song is this? And we say, you're listening to this song by Billy Joel. You want to buy it? And people are saying yes, which shows us the easier you make it for people to buy music legally, the more likely they are. When the music industry wouldn't let you buy songs digitally, guess what? They created Napster.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, I use Shazam.
I have a few times too.
Yeah. And I've always wondered, like, who's going to buy that? Come on. Who's going to buy music this way? And apparently, somebody.
And finally, the liner notes thing. I don't think old codgers who say they don't like digital downloads are strictly because I can't see who the engineer is on the album. But they, you know, people when they went from LPs to cassettes said, you're losing the big graphic cover art. You're losing the lyrics. You know, cassettes would have tiny little lyrics. You needed a magnifying glass to read. You know, that sort of stuff. It was a step down in pleasure as far as the visual appeal of an album. And then same thing with CDs. You had the little booklet and it seemed, you know, kind of lame compared to LPs. But then we went digital and suddenly we had nothing. And I frankly, half the time, I can't remember new artists, new albums and new song titles. Because I'm not staring at that CD or LP or cassette, looking at the name of the song over and over again while I listen to them. I'm not reading the lyrics because they aren't available. So I actually have a little more trouble remembering new acts. And it's not because I'm a senile old man. It's because I'm not seeing that name over and over again while I listen to the song.
That's true.
And that's sort of a problem. So it's nice to know that they're finally waking up and saying, you know what? People want to know what song they're listening to. They want lyrics. They want to be able to see if they're really into it. You know, who played on the track? Why not? So they should make it available. They should have been working on this from the beginning. There was no reason to ignore it.
Wait a second.
I'm glad to know that they are.
It's all about metadata and how you get metadata attached to a file.
Right, and they should have been working on that at the beginning.
They have been, and it's not as easy as flipping a switch. So Rhapsody hopes within the next 3 months to have all of this information.
But I mean, they've been selling digital music for how long now? The 90s, right?
No, the 2000s.
2000s. Well, it's been 13 years. They could have figured it out by now. They didn't care. It's not that it was difficult. They can send me movie files online. They can send me you're on satellite radio. They have the song title and artist all the time. You know, it's not that complicated.
Right, but they don't tell you who played bass.
Well, there's levels of, you know, information. If you're listening to a streaming song, you don't want to say, look at the credits for who played bass. You know, if you're looking at the whole album and sitting down, you want the full credits, that's fine. but they don't even tell you, you know, simple stuff sometimes. But anyway.
Yeah.
And I think they just didn't care. And now they realize, well, now the industry's saying, no, people care. We care. You need to do it. And now finally they're grudgingly agreeing to do it. I think it's a big deal.
Ooh, okay. So you don't want to talk about Kanye West because I know you don't think that's a big deal.
Well, we did. We talked about it. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing to say. He premiered a video in a clever way to gain attention. Good for him.
Yeah. So if that's not a big deal, then maybe you'll find some big deals in Big Deal or Big Whoop, which is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, ABC was the first major network to stream TV shows online the morning after they aired on TV. Now they're the first to make their local TV stations available via app to cable or satellite providers in major markets where ABC owns the local TV station. So they are owned and operated by ABC, those local affiliates. People with the app can watch, for example, the New York City ABC affiliate Channel 7 from Good Morning America to syndicated fare like Katie to primetime Grey's Anatomy to Late Night with Jimmy Kimmel. Or I guess it's the... What is it? Jimmy Kimmel Live is the show. They don't need to be in their home to access the app. They can look at it anywhere in the local market. ABC hopes to extend the offer to all the ABC affiliates for use in their local markets as well. Cable channels TNT and TBS announced similar plans across multiple platforms and dedicated apps. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? I mean, it is only the local markets. You can only watch New York TV in New York.
Yeah, well, they don't want someone in Timbuktu doing it, I guess. I think it's a big deal. I think it's the wave of the future. It's where everybody's slowly and carefully moving. They're being so cautious. They're like, but you still have to subscribe to cable, even though you could get it over the air on any TV you want. So why they think to look at the app, you should have to pay for cable when you can watch it on your TV anywhere in the city for free with an antenna. But they're still too scared to go that final step. But they're getting ready. They're getting closer. And it should be available anywhere in any way you want to look at it. So good for them.
Well, you know, you say it's the wave of the future, and I guess you're right, because, you know, maybe the well over $100 million YouTube spent on premium content during the past 18 months, maybe it's actually paying off. According to a report from Sandvine, which is an internet traffic management specialist, YouTube now accounts for 17.1% of data being transmitted or pushed into North American homes via fixed lines, and that means cable or DSL. That's what we're talking
70%
about.
70% of all traffic is YouTube.
Basically, yes.
Thank you.
But not wireless. You know, they're not.
Because you want whatever.
Yeah. Of course, Netflix, you know, they still rule the roost at 32.3% of all traffic being pushed into homes. But YouTube is up from their 13.8% figure last year. So, yes, I'm trying to throw a lot of numbers at you and hoping that you'll give me $5 in the end. In any case, with a site redesign and new paid channel subscriptions, the service seems to be growing faster than Netflix or any of its competitors.
That's a trick of statistics.
That's true.
It's so, growing faster. I guess what, I have the fastest growing website in the world because I just launched it.
Yeah, well, listen, what we're talking about here is big data. But is this news a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I don't know that we can link it to their new premium content. I mean,
no,
you know,
maybe not.
There's no proof of that in this. They're just saying the traffic grew about 20%?
I guess. I don't know.
1.3%, 2.6%.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
we're doing 20%. Math live. Yeah. Okay.
And that's the traffic. But again, they're measuring traffic going into homes. So that doesn't mean YouTube's making more money. Some other area could have fallen. You know, it's they're apples and oranges. First of all, the traffic level has nothing to do with the $100 million they spent on premium content. Secondly, the level of traffic, maybe somebody else just fell. Maybe somebody closed down, or maybe somebody has less traffic, and YouTube is only bigger percentage because something else dropped.
Well, so since they're comparing apples and oranges, maybe we should talk about Apple for a second.
Okay,
because
all right. But I'm just saying, it's a confused thing. The fact that their percentage of the total traffic going into a home increased 20% doesn't mean we know why. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily more popular. To know that, you'd have to look at how many people are on YouTube. How much are they watching? How much are they making ad buys, et cetera? So that's yeah. All right, their traffic, their percentage of the total traffic grew. Who cares?
Okay.
Big whoop. It's a big whoop.
Well, then let's talk about Apple, because Apple is ready to launch iRadio by the summer, but still needs to close a couple deals with Warner Brothers and Sony. With Sony, apparently they're playing hardball. They want a rate similar to what they get from Pandora, 12.5 cents. We've talked about that in the past, for every 100 tracks streamed. Apple is offering a more complicated approach. They're offering a royalty per track streamed, 50% of iRadio's revenue, and a guaranteed minimum. So an NG,
you're gonna get
minimum
get
guarantee.
Right.
No word on how that 50% share is split up among record labels. iRadio promises to offer the ability to fast forward and rewind songs, as well as a purchase button. There's your Shazam, Michael. And that'll take people, of course, straight to iTunes, where, of course, labels get a cut of all the sales. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop because it's a bump in the road. I guess it's a big deal to Google because they're trying to do the same similar service.
Well, they launched that similar service while I was in Cannes, so...
They did. Well, see, I didn't even notice it. Well, there's a big deal. Is it any good? Have you checked it out?
Haven't checked it out. You know, I'll check it out after I catch up on the thousands of emails that piled up.
And give us a report. So Apple wants to do it. They're saying, hey, we're not going to give you so much money up front, but you get a piece of the pie. And Warner Brothers is saying, nah, I'd rather have a lot of money up front.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, CBS is the number one major network by every measurement this year. It has the biggest audience, and it is the number one in all those key demographics, Michael, 18 to 49, that big demographic. Advertisers value that demo the most. It's the first time CBS has triumphed in that demo since, well, let's see, carry the 1991.
That's 22 years ago.
Yes, that was the era of Murphy Brown and Northern Exposure.
Loved Northern Exposure.
Yes, Fox fell hard thanks to the collapsing American Idol. It averaged 11.85 million viewers, a 4 million advantage.
This is CBS now.
Yes. So CBS averaged 11.85 million viewers. So that's a 4 million viewer advantage over its closest competitor. It wins,
wow,
even if you discount the massive Super Bowl numbers. Fox fell in the demo after winning, what was it, like 8 years in a row? NBC was a competitive third, actually, thanks to two shows, The Voice and Sunday Night Football. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, it's a huge triumph for CBS. People mocked them as being old fogies for years with, you know, aging procedural shows, but they've kept them fresh. They've inserted new shows. They've triumphed over everybody else. A huge advantage, 4 million viewer advantage over its close. When you're talking about 12 million viewer average, and that's 4 million viewers higher, that means the next competitor is about 8 million viewers. Wow, that is a big advantage in the world of networks. So all kudos to CBS. It's been a long time coming, 22 years in the making, that they are finally the number one network overall, which is all I care about, and in that key demo that advertisers value the most. So that's big, big news. And it's as much about the collapse of American Idol and the critical care needs of NBC as it is CBS, because they're all falling from where they were 20, 30 years ago.
Well, you know, now we won't have to hear them say, "You mock me." Now, that is a joke. That I wonder who would actually write in if you actually get that joke. You'll show your age.
Yeah.
Speaking of, in any case, YouTube star Ray William Johnson became famous with his regular postings making fun of viral videos, sort of a talk soup for YouTube. He posts new videos every Tuesday, and if subscribers equaled audience, he'd be, you know, a hit TV show, actually, a hit TV series. Johnson, in fact, has 8.7 million subscribers, and his videos have racked up more than 2.3 billion views.
That's a lot of advertising.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, 8.7 million is more than the series finale of The Office. That should tell you something. Now the cable channel FX has beaten out others by snagging Johnson for a sitcom based on, guess what? His life. They've made a script commitment, i.e., they'll pay for a script to be written, to be penned, as they say in Hollywood, and then decide to whether to move forward or not, you know, afterwards. So it'll be a sitcom on FX or perhaps, you know, their new channel, FXX. Ooh. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
A big whoop. I mean, it's great for Ray William Johnson, but it's not like he got a series on the air. They're like, well, we'll try a script out. So I also think it's weird that it's a sitcom. Shouldn't he be a host? Shouldn't he be on Talk Soup or Tosh 3.0, something like that? Why are they doing a sitcom?
I have no idea.
I really want to make fun of the way it was covered. The Hollywood Reporter said that, you know, FX beat out other competitors. They said in a competitive situation, FX has given script commitment to a comedy inspired by the life of the internet star. Well, who do they beat out? I mean, you can't do anything less than a script commitment. It's not like somebody said, well, we'll talk to you, we'll have a meeting, and they said, well, we'll have two meetings. I mean, that's the minimal that's the minimal amount you can do. So to talk about them beating out everybody else, clearly there wasn't a lot of heat. Or, you know, he would have had an offer to host a show, or he would have had a, you know, a 6-episode deal, you know.
Well, we'll take you to lunch. We'll take you to dinner.
We'll take you to dinner. We'll throw in wine. Exactly. So the Hollywood Reporter's got to calm down on the hype. But, you know, good for him. It got me to watch one of his videos. It was kind of funny. It's not something I would watch regularly. He's just looking at stupid online videos and making fun of him. But he had an appealing on-camera presence and a droll delivery. I could see why you think he might be a good sitcom star. But to me, he seems more like a host of the future. I'd rather watch him than Jimmy Kimmel. I'll tell you that.
So let's talk about Zach Braff. Here's what happened.
This is another con story, isn't it? You're just going to rub it in my face that you're a con, weren't you?
I don't know. Let's find out. You know, okay. TV star Zach Braff, he made his feature film directorial debut in 2004 with a labor of love called Garden State. It cost $2.6 million to make and grossed $36 million worldwide. So that's a hit. On top of that, it was a big hit on DVD, spawned a Grammy-winning soundtrack overseen by Braff himself, and got great reviews. Braff wrote a new script called Wish I Was Here. We kind of talked about this a few weeks ago. And he wrote it with another modest budget mind of less than $10 million. He shopped it around and nothing happened.
Which is bizarre as far as I'm concerned. It's ridiculous.
Well, no one trusted Braff at any studio with a follow-up to his hit.
I would have.
Finally, in frustration, he launches this Kickstarter campaign and raised more than $2 million in 3 days. Again, we covered that. Ultimately, I think he raised, I think it's over $3 million now for his movie. Now a company has stepped in at Cannes to announce they'll provide what's called gap financing. And that plus overseas pre-sales will allow Braff to film with a budget just shy of $10 million and a cast that includes Josh Gad from The Book of Mormon. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Josh Gad certainly isn't busy since 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue was just canceled. It's a big deal. It's what Kickstarter thinks should do. I don't know whether fans will feel, I'm cheated. It's like they're chipping in, they're fans, they want to help him get his project done. And now the best possible, ending has happened where he's gotten a bigger budget to make the movie he wants to make with the money he wants. And they help make it happen. So everybody's happy. But there's more to the story, isn't there?
That's true. And I could play the whole bit about how he's telling Woody Allen. But basically, long story short, or short story shorter, apparently he was in Woody Allen's office meeting with Woody Allen when this whole Kickstarter thing blew up. The day the campaign started and it was making so much money. And Woody Allen said, well, what's all this about?
He's like, what's the internet?
Yeah. And the computer.
Sun Yi keeps trying to get me to go onto the Twitter, but I can't do it.
Right. Oh, my goodness. And so he hears about this thing called crowdfunding and he makes Zach Braff tell him all about it. And he gets so excited.
I could just get fans to give me $30 million and I can make any movie I want.
Yeah. And so apparently Woody Allen's assistant emailed Zach Braff and said, it asked for more information. And Zach Braff put a little PS in the response saying, hey, I'll never forget that it was me that educated Woody Allen about crowdfunding. And the assistant wrote back, yeah, you did such a good job. You won't stop talking about it.
That's funny.
But I'd give Woody Allen money.
Oh, I thought it happened at Cannes where they bumped into each other.
No, not at all.
No. So that's why I thought it was a Cannes story. Oh, well.
No. Well, okay. So let's talk about Barnes & Noble. We talked about them, we talk about them all the time. They're the booksellers. Their stock has staggered back to earth after those rumors of Microsoft buying the Nook division proved to be just that. Rumors with no foundation in fact. But at least there's good news in the UK. There, the company has slashed the price of the e-reader, that the Nook Simple Touch, from £80 to £30, or about $46.
They're giving it away.
Yes, they can't give them away fast enough. At that price, they're completely sold out in stores and even on the Barnes & Noble's website, .co.uk. And unlike their more flexible tablets, the Nook Simple Touch is strictly an e-reader, and people wanting to buy books are sent only to Barnes & Noble. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, I think. Anybody would know that, hey, if you sell them at cost, like Amazon's been doing, you're going to sell more of them and get people on board and lock them into your universe of the Barnes & Noble world. That was perhaps the wave of the future. They've created good Nooks and tablets, but they have not been able to succeed digitally. And this shows that there's still life in them because it is a good tablet. It is a good e-reader. And people do like it. And I don't know if it's too late in the day, but they've got a strategy that can work in some parts of the world. And I think there's a lot more life in the e-reader. I know I'm wrong about this. I know the tablets sell a lot more. And everybody says, well, why would you buy an e-reader when you can just buy a tablet? And I know the tablets are getting lighter and thinner. But frankly, most of the time, I'm happy just to carry my e-reader around. I've got 600 books on it. It's simple. It works great. And I don't need a tablet with me all day long. On my phone, I go online and do what I need to do. I don't really need a tablet that much. So if you're talking about portability, the even lighter e-reader in my phone is plenty.
Well, you darn well better have 600 books on your e-reader, given what we've
got. I do, yeah.
Well, this is truly the end of an era. American Idol finished its 12th season with a record low finale, reaching only 14 million people, far less than last season's then record low of 21 million people, or as everybody likes to call 14 million people, hey, I'd like to have that much many people watch my show.
Yeah, and, it's the number one show on Fox.
Yeah, they also lost almost 50% of that key demo, 18 to 49-year-olds. It's rumored that none of the judges will be back next season, and clearly The Voice on NBC is the one to watch.
So none of their acts look like actual people who will record albums and have hits. And believe me, I just watched the final eight.
Well, Idol will barely still be in the top 10. This puts the kibosh on a series that was the number one TV show in the country for an unprecedented 8 straight years. They sold countless digital singles and albums and launched the careers of some of the biggest Grammy-winning multi-platinum acts in showbiz today. From pop to country to Broadway to the movies, doesn't matter. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's inevitable. You know, we saw it coming. I didn't want to admit to it. I said, oh, hold on. Okay, it happened. So, yes, I have to face reality. You know, it's the 12th season, for God's sake. I mean, shows lasting that long is incredibly unusual. To be number one for 8 years in a row is unusual. It's sad to see it come to an end in some ways, but they're still finding a lot of talent. And now next year, of course, CeeLo and Christina Aguilera are coming back for the fall edition of The Voice, though I bet they couldn't demand as much money as they wanted after Shakira and Usher came on the show and its ratings were as big as ever. But frankly, it's just a snooze to watch that show. All they ever do is say how wonderful everybody is. It's boring. I long for Simon Cowell and The X Factor. And now for next season for American Idol, they're talking about bringing back all graduates of the show as the judging panel. They're talking about Adam Lambert. What's his name? Season 2 loser. He came out gay. What the heck's his name? Not the teddy bear, but you know, he sang Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Adam Clay's
Clay Aiken, thank you. And maybe Kelly Clarkson, who denied it. And
who denied Jennifer, what?
Yeah, she denied that she's coming back on the show and is involved in discussions. Okay. And Jennifer Hudson, who of course is a big winner. So they're talking about a panel of all those kids. That actually be kind of fun. I actually would that's a fun idea.
Stunt judges.
Well, that's what they all are, but they've all, you know, she's won an Oscar. They've won Grammys. They've won, you know, they've sold millions of copies of albums. You know, been on the cover of Rolling Stone. They're not, you know, nobodies. They've proven themselves in the real world. And I like that idea. So we'll have to see if that happens. But no matter what happens, it ain't ever going to be what it was once upon a time.
Just a few weeks into the bold experiment to keep daytime soaps alive online, the episodes have been, well, cut back dramatically from 4 a week for All My Children and One Life to Live to 2 a week. Alternate, you know, they're alternating one per day and, you know, capping the week off on Friday. They'll do a recap and a behind the scenes show. No actual numbers on episodes downloaded or watched has been widely available yet. Or as I like to say, hey, it ain't the 1950s. Ain't nobody watching your shows. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, they have no numbers. We don't know what's going on, but we do know that they've cut back their episodes by 50%. Not a good sign for this experiment. It's a shame because those are name brands. All My Children, One Life to Live. They're saying, oh, people were overwhelmed. They had too many episodes to watch. But I think the fact is that in this day and age, what people were doing, even when the shows were on networks, was taping the week and watching them all at once, you know, zipping through 4 episodes or 5 episodes on like a weekend. And there was that soap channel where they would show them all back to back.
AKA binge viewing.
Right. And I think they're saying, you know what? There's no point in giving them 4 episodes. They're just going to watch them all at once anyway. So 2 episodes is plenty. It gives them their soap feedback. That's the most positive spin I can put on it. That they've said, all right, we looked at the numbers. People are happy. They like the show. But we don't need to spend the money on 4 episodes a week because people are just soaking them all up. So let's give them 2, give them their soap fix, and see how that works. But again, how are you going to keep those actors on payroll? Because they're like, hey, I'm used to being paid a lot more money. So we'll have to see how it works out, but not a good sign.
Well, that might not be a good sign, but the news is all good at ESPN, unless you actually work there. Forbes recently named it the most valuable media property and estimated its worth at $40 billion. That's with a B, $40 billion. Profits and revenue, and it's one, you know, they're all up, and it's one of the most consistently lucrative areas of the Disney empire. Last year, to the tune of $1.86 billion in its division's operating income. So How did Disney celebrate? How do you think they celebrated? By firing more than 400 employees. Its first wave of layoffs since 2009. Disney claims firing 400 employees will somehow make them more productive? Imagine that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael.
No, Imagineer that.
Oh, Imagineer that. Oh, that's a good one. Yes.
Thank you. This is now Showbiz Communard Sandbox. But anyway, it's like, yes, of course, everything's going great. We're making tons of money. You're all fired. It's just bizarre. Literally, corporations have decided employees are completely unnecessary. No company wants to have people on their payroll. It's a stupid waste of time and money. Why would you ever want that? If you have to, let them be freelance. It's where we're at in America today. By the way, I just finished a great book called The Unwinding by George Packer. Great book about the last 40 years of America, nonfiction work, terrific reporting. Check it out.
And yes,
if you're wondering what the heck's been going on in this country, this book nails it to a T.
Wow. Okay. Well, I was wondering what was going on with this price fixing lawsuit. And just minutes before the trial was set to start, Penguin decided, hey, you know what? Just kidding. We'll settle. And they settled the price fixing lawsuit in concert with 33 state attorneys general. Penguin will pay out $75 million, leaving Apple, well, completely alone at the defense table when the trial begins on June 3rd. Big deal, big whoop.
Big deal. It's very sad. I don't think any of these companies were necessarily guilty of price fixing. I think they were doing business as usual, and I think that they got pressured into it and decided it was cheaper to just settle rather than fight. And that's too bad, because I think ultimately it was going to be for the betterment of the publishing industry. Apple is all alone. The judge just announced the other day, she said, all right, they've been doing lots of pretrial evidentiary hearings and evidence has been submitted. And she said, I'm looking at all the evidence here and it don't look good, Apple. Yeah. She said, you know, you're going to have to, and people in the publishing industry are like, oh my God, how could she do that? How could she tell them what she thinks about the trial before it's even begun? It's outrageous.
Well, and because she's trying to save everybody millions
right.
of dollars.
And lawyers are saying, no. When it's not a jury trial, it's quite common for the judge to given, you know, they know what she's thinking anyway, in various ways, large and small. But she wants him to settle him. She says, hey, look, you don't have a good case here. You better have a lot more stuff to bring up in trial. But right now I'm looking at it and they've got a good case and it doesn't look good. And you sure you don't want to settle? Save everybody time and money. So that's what that was about. But it does not look good for Apple. They're all alone. And the judge is saying, I don't know, it looks pretty bad.
Fans have been filling web pages with fan fiction for years. Fan fiction is, you know, when people write new adventures for, say, Sherlock Holmes, but more often it's current hot properties like the Twilight movies or Star Trek and so on. Often they're in the spirit of the original, but just as often they're wish fulfillment of things fans know they'll never see, like a gay romance between Kirk and Spock, or Bella dumping both the vampire and the werewolf for a zombie, or fiction in which main characters die or kill or do something wildly unexpected, like actually tell a good story. Because so much fan fiction revolves around properties under trademark, it's had a quasi-black market feel to it. Now it's going legit with Amazon creating official sites where people can write fan fiction for certain properties. They're launching with Gossip Girl, The Vampire Diaries, and Pretty Little Liars. Fans can post their fiction, and if other people like it, even make some money off of it. Then, you know, they'll sell it and license it, and, well, big deal or big whoop, Michael.
It's a big deal. Fan fiction's been around since the internet. It's been like a black market sort of under the radar thing. As we all know, the 50 Shades of Grey sprang up from fan fiction written for Twilight, which shows you how far afield of the actual property the fan fiction can become. It had the names of Bella and whatever and Edward or whatever their names are, but it had nothing to do with Twilight. But nonetheless, it's fun for fans, and Amazon's figured out a way to monetize it. They work with the companies and say, hey, we'll set up the site. We'll split royalties. If anybody actually buys the stuff that these kids create on their own, you know, hey, we all make money. So it's interesting. And it's I'm sure someday we'll hear a story about a kid being hired to be a writer on Pretty Little Liars or some other TV show because they like the fan fiction they were writing. It doesn't mean this is a new way and slush piles and internships are all the thing of the past, but it is a new path to the world where fans can indulge themselves officially and actually get a little more attention and in a crazy world actually make some money.
Well, now let me ask you this.
It's a phenomenon, and they figured out a smart way to monetize it. Good for them.
Well, with all of this fan fiction, okay, there's going to be even more titles available, right?
So, well, yeah, I mean, anybody who wants to will say, hey, let's do it with Amazon, or do it ourselves.
More books published, whether ebooks or paper, you know, traditional dead tree. So yeah. How is one to actually decide whether they should purchase this fan fiction or or what was the book by Packer that you just mentioned? The Unwinding?
The Unwinding. Yeah. I don't know.
So, you know what? I have no idea which book to read because I generally only read the internets. And, well, that's our topic for Inside Baseball this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. A couple points. This story will affect you, and you should go to bookfilter.com. So, A. And, B, this week we're actually making the headlines.
That's right. Thank God. It's about time.
That's right.
So, bookfilter.com, it's in the beta stage. But I wanted to share it with fans
and
show
and
the sandbox.
Beta stage, where is beta stage? Is it where, I mean, what was put on there last? Was it Venus and Fur? Was it?
That means it's in beta stage. It's online. It's active, but it's not ready for the public unveiling yet. I'm not reaching out to the traditional media and trying to get traditional coverage. I'm introducing it to people in the industry this weekend at the Book Expo of America, which is taking place in New York City this Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'll be around sharing details about it. I'm looking to get coverage in the industry papers like Publishers Weekly and Library Journal and places like that, introducing it to publicists and PR people and editors and people in all the different publishing houses. And I'm sharing it with the fans of Showbiz Sandbox. It's up, it's functioning, but it's not wholly there yet. So what you'll see if you go to bookfilter.com is a website where we've got information on books coming out every week in every category. It's sort of like a fall book preview or a summer movie preview, but I do it every week for every category. So if you're a fan of mysteries, romance, cookbooks, history, biography, sports, whatever the genre.
Fan fiction.
No, we don't have fan fiction as such, but you'll find on bookfilter.com. Our focus at first is, of course, on the big publishing companies, and we'll slowly expand and keep adding more publishing houses. I mean, there are 300,000 books published every year by the industry, 3 million if you count self-published books. Nobody can cover or read all of them, but we want to be as comprehensive as possible, starting with the big boys. It's like if we had a website about television, we want to start with ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, right? We're on books, and so we want to start with the big publishing companies. There are the big six. So our website is set up, it's functioning, and we have feeds that is information from Random House, Macmillan, and Simon & Schuster. Those are three of the big six. We also have a number of indie houses. We're adding on Harper & Collins, and once they're done, we'll move on to Hachette and Penguin. Once we've got those big six all there, you'll see virtually every bestseller that you see on the charts. Every big title from every big publishing house, you'll find it on Bookfilter as soon as it's available.
But they're rated, right? I mean, it's like just because it's a bestseller doesn't mean it's going to be number one.
No. I'm just saying we'll have information from everybody. Right now, if you go to our site, you will not. It's like if you went to a TV site. We don't have Fox and NBC yet. We've got ABC and CBS and ESPN and a lot of big cable channels, but we don't have all the networks. We're adding them on. It's a technical challenge. So when you go to the site and you're looking at displays of new books that are coming out, you won't see every single book that's available in the world, but you will see a lot of them. It's like a preview site. Go to bookfilter.com, open an account, and check out the site for yourself, and you'll see what it's like.
Well, is it a bookstore? I'm gonna ask you some leading questions here.
All right, here we go.
Is it a bookstore?
No, it's not a bookstore. It's a portal to talk about books. Hopefully, before you go to your favorite bookstore or library or online retail like Amazon or Barnes & Noble, you'll come to bookfilter.com, and that will help you see all the new books that came out this week, and it will also give you picks of the top books that we're most excited about. Books we've read or books we're excited to read, books that got great reviews, books that were bestsellers overseas. We'll show you a list of all the top books and say, hey, these are the 10 big mysteries coming out this week. These are the 8 really good sci-fi books coming out this week. These are the 12 great sports books. These are the 5 great cookbooks. Whatever the category, we'll have our top picks there for you. And then if you're really a fan, you can show all releases and click a button and see every single book coming out this week in every category. You can see every single book in the history section, every single book in mystery, every single book in romance, every single book in sci-fi, if you're that big a fan. If you're a casual reader, you might want to just look at the top picks for the month or the season. And in like a few minutes, you'll walk away with a lot of great ideas of books to read. So when you're saying to yourself, what should I read next? You want some ideas? You can come to Bookfilter and walk away with, you know, a dozen books that you want to read.
So is that really what inspired it, that you were saying, gee, what should I read next? And you said, what? There's no place for me to go.
Well, a lot of things inspired it. One is that I love books and love talking about them. And one of the most fun things I've done over the years is a fall book preview, a holiday gift guide for like the New York Post, the New York Daily News, Entertainment Weekly, other newspapers, magazines, and websites. I've done these over the years, and it's really fun. I love all sorts of genres. And most of the time, all you get to talk about are like the major big best-selling authors. And maybe once or twice a year, you get to do a kid's book or a cookbook. And that's it. But when you do a fall preview or you do a holiday gift guide, they don't care what you do. They just want you to get a good mix of books. So I could go out and say, oh, this looks great. I'm really interested in reading this. I've read an advanced galley of that. And suddenly in about 10 minutes, you've got a display of 30 or 40 books coming out in the fall. And it's pretty easy to see what are the top books, what are the big books, you know, the best-selling authors. But you can also spot what books are look really promising. They've gotten great early reviews, or they were big hits overseas, or it's just a topic you love, or best of all, you've read it and you know it's great. Like, I've already read the new novel by Jhumpa Lahiri. It comes out in September. It comes out in September. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and her new novel is called The Lodeland. It's terrific. It's a brilliant novel. It'll be one of the big books of the year. It has a 500,000 copy first printing. She's a big best-selling author. She's critically acclaimed. The publisher's behind it. I've read it. It's brilliant. Clearly, in September, that will be one of the big books of the year. I've read it. I love it. So I've already written a review.
Blue is the warmest color for books.
That's right. There's no lesbian cut. Oh, I shouldn't say that necessarily. It's Susan. Of lesbian content, but just a tiny little hint. But it's a terrific novel. And so that's the sort of thing that you spot way in advance and can say, oh, wow, now I know that this book's coming out. I can tell people with confidence, this is a book you'll want to read. This is a book you would love, especially if you're a fan of hers. But if you haven't read her before, this is a great place to start.
What should I expect when I get to bookfilter.com? I mean, I see here that there's all these books with numbers. What should people expect?
Well, the main way people find out what books are coming out is they walk into a bookstore. Literally, that's the only way they have to find out what books are out. They go into the store, they look around, they look at the new release section, they walk up and down the aisles, and they usually do it with their Kindle or their iPad in hand, and they buy the book online.
But wait that's a second, when do they get to the Starbucks?
That's why Barnes & Noble is going out of business, because people are not buying books in the store, they're buying them online more and more often. But to find out what's out, they got to go to a bookstore. So I created the site so that you could browse for books online the way you do in a physical bookstore. If you know what you're looking for, of course, you can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon, type in the name, and there it is. But if you want to look around, you just want ideas of what's come out, those sites are terrible for discovering books. They're terrible for browsing around. So my site is designed like a physical bookstore. When you come to the front page at bookfilter.com, you'll see a collection of all the new hits coming out from the current week, all the books that I think are the most exciting and interesting that came out this week. So you'll see on the front page a new cookbook, a new fiction, new children's book, new sports, biography. Whatever I think the best books are coming out this week, they'll be displayed on the front page. That's what you see. It's kind of like the table that you see in the front of a store when you walk into a bookstore. There's that front table with a display of new releases.
Yeah, the problem is that table is usually in my way as I'm trying to get to the Starbucks.
That's right. And that table, by the way, is not carefully chosen books placed there by the manager and the employees who love books. Those are ads paid for by the publisher. The publisher pays to have their book put on that front table. They pay to have their book put in the new release section. They pay to have their book put at the end caps at the end of each aisle. Those are not choices made by the staff. Those are advertisements paid for by the publisher. Unlike every other website, and like every other bookstore you walk into, when you go to my website, those picks are my personal passionate picks, myself and my staff at bookfilter.com. Those are the books we are actually excited by. We don't care if it's a large house or a small publishing house. We don't care if the author's a bestseller or is a new person you never heard of. If we're excited by the book, we're going to put it out there. And you'll always know that those are our personal recommendations, not ads paid for by the publisher. So you walk to the website, it's like walking in the front door, there's that table of new releases. Then if you're like most people, you say, well, I'm really looking for a mystery. So you click on the tab on the left for mystery, and that takes you to the mystery section. Again, you're in the current week, and there's a display of 8 or 10 or 12, however many books we're excited about, that came out that current week. Now, if you want to look into the future and see what books are coming out down the road, you can go forward week by week. If you want to have a bigger overview, you can click to month or season and see the top books or all releases coming out in mystery for this week or this month of May or the season of April, May, and June. And you can also go back in time. So if you're looking for a book to read right now, you can go a little bit back in time and see books that came out last week, the week before that. And before that, you'll have a list of books that you're excited to read about. If you want to see what's coming out in the future, you can peek ahead into the future, look at what's coming up down the road. Put it on your account, on your wish list, and when the book comes out, we'll let you know so that you won't forget about it. So there's a lot of great things to do. It lets you browse for books online the way you do in a bookstore. It provides comprehensive information you can't get anywhere else, including in the industry. There's nowhere to go if you're in the industry to find out what books are coming out the first or second week of June or July. Nowhere to go. We know what books are coming out in December, but as far as a clearinghouse that provides all that info, you can't get it anywhere else but bookfilter.com. So you can peek into the future. You can see what comes out this week. You can browse around just like you do in a bookstore. And if you're looking for books to read, you'll have about a dozen ideas in 5 minutes. So before you go to your library, before you go to your favorite local bookstore, before you go to your online site, or if you just finished a book and said, well, what should I read next? Come to bookfilter.com and hopefully we'll help you answer that question. And you become a fan. You keep coming back. Share it with your friends. Check it out. Give me your feedback. And when we're going to launch it officially, I'll certainly let everybody know again so you can spread the word to the world.
Wow. So it seems like you've got your sales pitch down.
I hope so.
Well, you know what?
I have to do it about 1,000 times this weekend when I go to the Book Expo of America.
That's true. And you know what? We have a little pitch for you, and that is that you can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free is where you can find us. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox. We're also on Facebook, where we have a page that you could like. Showbiz Sandbox is our username there. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You could also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us in iTunes or elsewhere, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And, well, we really just encourage you to visit the site, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. I know Michael Giltz has a website, and this week I have a feeling I know what it is. Michael,
take a guess.
Bookfilter.com.
Exactly.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.